You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Good morning. Today is a lovely day, and today I want to share some thoughts with you about what I consider to be some important issues. We've had the benefit, through the music, through the storytelling, of the aspect of environmental stewardship. So that's a good start. The address, as you can refresh your memory, is about agriculture, it's about religion, maybe strange bedfellows, and about environmental stewardship. And so I'll tell you a little bit about my background. I was on a farm. That's the first step, so I know a bit about farming. Attended an agricultural high school, an agricultural college, and taught at Roseworthy Agricultural College. So I know a bit about agriculture. What do I know about religion? Well, it's up to you to find out. Maybe quite a bit. Who knows? So in my thinking, in its broader sense, it means cropping, of course. Animal husbandry, viticulture, horticulture, and much more. Stewardship, broader sense, it includes all of those things. Stewardship implies a responsibility, and where coupled with the word environmental, it encapsulates one of the major roles of the current generation of dwellers on this earth. The current generation, you and me and everyone in this room and everyone in this neighborhood, have a responsibility to look after the resources that have been provided to us. As was mentioned earlier, this wise Indian chief from the past said this sort of thing: "We do not inherit the earth and all its resources from our forebears. We borrow it from our children." This is a very serious matter when we think about our obligation to the next generation and the unborn. Religion is a term used to describe a set of beliefs and of worldviews. The array is very broad. There's a spectrum of religions from animism, the belief that God is in everything, the rocks, the trees, through pantheism, which is similar but not the same. I'll talk more about pantheism later. Buddhism, Hinduism, Zoroastrianism, Judaism, Islam, and of course the Eastern Orthodox and the Western Christianities, which include Catholicism, Protestantism, as well as a whole array of sects. S-E-C-T, we better have that right. So what I plan to talk about today does not involve sectarianism and not even only Christianity. There are many other things to talk about. So, agriculture and religion are inextricably joined in our history. It was agriculture that allowed the settled division of labor, which produced the classes of people who later went on to codify our religions, explaining their deeper intents. And religious writers used metaphor from the main occupation of the day, which at that time was agriculture. If you look at the Torah, the Quran, the Bible, many, many references. Sow what you reap, reap what you sow, all this sort of stuff, about the figs sending out their fruits before they send out the leaves, etc., and so on. So, plenty of references to that. An animal husbandry, sheep that get lost, the sheep that need to have new pastures, and so on. So, agriculture provides themes and examples for Christian and other teachings, not because agriculture itself is special, although access to food obviously is, but because the teachings were formulated in an area when agriculture was a major occupation of advanced societies. See, there were other societies that were mainly hunter-gatherers, and agriculture was an advancement on this. So the Bible in particular is replete with agricultural references. not only to food production, but also to justice, compassion, and stewardship. Justice is represented as equity of access to the natural resources required for family food production, to ensure that everyone who needed such things got access. Compassion was about sharing and caring for all of nature. And stewardship is representative as respecting and valuing the natural environment through responsible use that considers the future generations. We call this intergenerational equity, our responsibility to the yet unborn. And this question of intergenerational equity is a topic for another day. It's quite a complex one, but we won't delve into it today. But I cannot let this moment pass, though, without telling you a true story about my teaching days in the university. We were discussing intergenerational equity, and I told the students I wanted to quote Marx. They all groaned. "Lefty," they said. But I proceeded, and I told them that Marx once remarked, "What should I do for the coming generations? What have they ever done for me?" Well, the students were a bit taken aback. They said, "Ah," stunned silence. Then one student asked, "Did Marx really say that?" I assured them that he did, except this was Groucho Marx, not Karl Marx. So agriculture, which is based on settled communities, is often assumed to have provided the stability needed for cultural development, including sophisticated religion, and may be seen more as a product than as a source of religion. See, they're inextricably bound. If the people weren't settled, if they weren't able to sort out the different classes of people, different responsibilities, different needs, then religion may not have happened in the way that it did. So as the tribes from which we're all derived, if we go back far enough, we'll find we all came from tribes. As these tribes expanded, their religion spread. They absorbed new ingredients until the great universal religions arose. Religions not limited to a select group, these were more general, universal in fact. These great religions that have survived until today, though differing from each other, have also contained similar insights, such as been demonstrated in Indian Mahayana Buddhism, in Near Eastern Gnosis, and also had a major effect on the development of Christianity. In fact, the teachings of such luminaries as the Buddha and Jesus may even relate more closely to each other than to their subsequent traditions. Hunter-gatherers, the people I mentioned a moment ago, are romantically said to have lived day to day, eating as they hunted and gathered food. They lived in the present. Every day was a new challenge. Agriculture, on the other hand, required planning, sowing of the crops, when to sow, when to harvest, how to remember the sequence of years, crop yields up, down, depending on the rain and other factors, and learning the complexities of interfering with the natural system. When you cultivate, when you grow crops, you cause a great disturbance to the natural order. So we note that hunting also requires planning, but it's a different sort of planning. The point is that humans gradually ceased to be molded by the environment and began to mold themselves and their environment. Cutting down the forest to make way for cropland, draining of swamps and marshes are two examples, damming of rivers to maintain a water supply and other examples. But by definition, modern agriculture does not work within the natural order. It seeks to maintain an isolated, unnatural order. What I mean by that is that if we look at commercial agriculture, this diagram, I'm not going to give you a lecture about it, but the key point is that commercial farms are much more simple, biotically simpler than the traditional polycultural systems. Up here in this diagram, you'll see some numbers like 7, 8, 5. That means that certain areas of the ecosystem have a large variety of species. Cast your eyes over here, you'll see 999. That means all of that diversity has been replaced by one crop, maize, wheat, rice, or whatever. Enough about that. In the beginning, there was God. Ah, yes, we better have that one. In the beginning. So Western culture taught us there was a cosmic hierarchy led by God as a creator, and we were independent clones. He made man in his own image. We're therefore superior to other elements in nature. This was when the rot started to set in. Once man had this elevated status and was superior to all other forms of nature, then trouble began. The conventional view in Christianity is now being challenged, of course, as other diverse relationships of God with creation. But such a conventional theology requires what I've elsewhere referred to as experiential knowledge or participating knowledge. Experiential knowledge here means a knowledge developed from internal mental development, sometimes referred to as mystical insight, and differs from the dualistic subject-object reasoning that might accompany rational thought. We have this, therefore that. This other stuff is more mystical. Such insight involves understanding an object as integral with its surroundings, rather than as the sum of its individually analyzed components. Or put it another way, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Take my watch here. If I open this watch up and put all the bits on the desk, I have the whole thing, but it doesn't work. Only when it's put in the right combination and the right order does it work. So, now I want to talk about pantheism and animism, two of the major belief systems in many parts of the world. There are probably more people collectively who believe in this sort of religion than there are in the other. So in sharp contrast to most religions, pantheism sees the divine in nature. This is quite different from the concept of the Buddha, who sees nature in all things. Subtle difference, but important difference. There's some confusion about the distinction between pantheism and animism. Animism is the religious belief that objects, places, and creatures all possess a distinct spiritual essence. Potentially, animism perceives all things, animals, plants, rocks, rivers, weather systems, human handcraft, and even words, as animated and alive. Modern pantheism draws support from all religions, scientific pantheism. This explains that the universe and nature are divine. It purports to align religion and science. Pantheism is in the main a beneficial platform for environmental awareness. It provides a useful contrast with the environmentally destructive image of Christianity. More on that later. Pantheism views nature to be sacred and thus worthy of preservation in terms of its beauty, its diversity, its health, and encourages to widen our contact with nature. It has been represented both as a plausible religion in its own right and a belief system that can be practiced in parallel with other religions. Pantheism also differs from the Gaia hypothesis that John spoke about a few weeks ago. It's a useful conception of the interconnectedness of all things within a belief structure, although it too seems to be being taken literally as a belief system by some. But while pantheism highlights our relationship with our surroundings, it falls short of our more critical relationship with our own consciousness. It can even be a stumbling block when the examples it chooses for verification are misinterpretations of metaphors and allegories. Regardless of its limitations in religious terminology, pantheism remains a useful device to consider the divine in all things. In agriculture, it encourages care for the land, for the soil, for the rocks, the insects, the plants, the animals, and more importantly, ourselves. We have to look after not only those in order for us to survive. Living as part of nature is more than what is popularly called nature-loving. It includes complex theological thought that offers one a means of correcting a false view of reality. Rather than controlling nature to produce food, for example, living as part of nature implies that actions be conducted within natural cycles. In practical terms, this means producing food with minimal interference with natural rhythms, as many environmentalists say. But living as part of nature could also be interpreted as understanding nature in more detail than the crude perceptions our human senses allow. This squarely opens the way to the application of science to sustainable agriculture. The alternative is to act arrogantly toward nature, on which we are a part. So we have this contrast between working with nature or working with little regard for nature. The argument suggests that there is an impending ecological crisis which can only be averted through a more sensitive relationship with nature. And even as long ago as the 6th century, Saint Benedict of Nursia promoted reverential draining of swamps, clearing of forests, improvement of agricultural fields for human benefit. It's not to say people with this point of view don't need to change things, otherwise there'd be no food. But it has to be done in a reverential way, trying to minimize the impact rather than go in with a big D9 caterpillar and knock down all the trees. However, before environmental saints were popular, the soil conservation Dr. William Loudermilk, a soil scientist, closed the loop between sustainable agriculture and popular Christian thought on religion. He argued that an omniscient, all-knowing God would have foreseen the impact of thoughtless agricultural management and would have intended a 11th commandment. The 11th commandment, thou shalt inherit the holy earth as a faithful steward, conserving its resources and productivity from generation to generation. Thou shalt safeguard thy fields from soil erosion, thy living waters from drying up, thy forests from desolation, and protect the hills from overgrazing by thy herds, that thy descendants may have abundance forever. If any shall fail in the stewardship of the land, thy fruitful fields shall become sterile, stony ground, and wasting gullies. And thy descendants shall decrease and live in poverty, or perish from off the face of the earth. So this one escaped Mr. Moses. He didn't get that one. Now, I want to return to consider how much Western society in particular has contributed to the poor environmental stewardship. Lynn White wrote a damning document in which he proposed that Western civilization, which was mostly, nominally at least, Christian, was a major cause of environmental destruction. In support of this view, the biblical injunctions to be fruitful and multiply, to have dominion over the earth, were cited. According to Lynn White, the roots of our ecological crisis and materialistic worldviews are derived from the biblical view of the role of human beings in nature and the Western philosophy. Genesis 1:28, God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, and over every living creature that moves on the ground." So this seemed like a carte blanche. Subdue, suppress, use, exploit. Now Christianity bears a heavy burden of guilt for the disastrous consequences of technological advance over the last 180 years. At least 180 years. Lynn White was quick to point out that the Western form of Christianity, which identified itself with the Western form of science, should be differentiated from the Eastern form of Christianity, which merged its lifestyle with Eastern way of thinking. In the West, the dawn of naturalism was initiated in 1859 through the publication of Darwin's theory of evolution through natural selection, which started the process of eliminating the reality of God from much of Western thought. People said, well, we don't need God, you know, we've got another explanation. Darwinism and positivism exerted a real influence on the scientific world to the extent of separating theology from biology. Western culture, tradition, and science can be traced back to Greek, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim foundations of thought. All of these cultures have considered that man is a special species in creation. The Greek philosopher Aristotle considered that man is unique among the animals because he's rational. He can think. Man is said to be made in God's image with dominion over all in the earth. So we may choose to see a peaceful and responsible ruler rather than one of uncaring exploitation of the earth, plants and animals. See, having dominion over the earth doesn't mean exploit and destroy. It can mean something else. This interpretation accords with the attendant blessing that man should enjoy and live from the fruits of nature to produce food and shelter and other requirements. Living as part of nature implies that actions be conducted within natural cycles. Until recently, humans only had the power to modify the natural order minutely, and usually in ways that could be pushed aside by nature if they overstepped the mark. Nevertheless, the deserts of sand, vast areas with soil erosion, salt-affected land, etc., to which most cultures have contributed across the millennia, testify to either our ignorance of or lack of concern for agricultural sustainability. Notwithstanding that the influence of Christianity has declined in Western societies, almost in step with the ascendance of modern obsession with the environment, and in particular stewardship and sustainability. Stewardship is a common link between Christian ethics and sustainable agriculture. This can be paraphrased as stewardship of God's earth for the benefit of our children's children, getting back to our Indian chief thinking. So with the irony that often accompanies desperation, most churches, most branches of the Christian church in particular, now advocate stewardship and sustainability as a newfound virtue, setting aside the implications of genetic immortality. They forget about that. Anyway, stewardship may be discussed as distinctly Protestant or at least post-Reformation term that has been reunited to domesticity with its siblings, economy and ecology. Both of them come from the Greek ekos. So economy, ecology, and stewardship, all part of the one family of words. These last mentioned words share the same Greek derivation. Proponents often trace stewardship back to Joseph. You remember him back in the days of Pharaoh. He worked as a steward in the house of Potiphar, a captain in Pharaoh's palace guard. And then it is broadened to acknowledgement of God as the ultimate owner of everything, who entrusts all creation to mankind. Seeing oneself as part of nature makes stewardship an act of self-interest. Now, a statement that I picked up while studying in the USA still resonates with me today, and that's this one. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. I think it has a lot of merit, that expression, and we have to watch out that we're not part of the problem. Now, I want to close with some words from Yvonne Arbour, a Unitarian minister. Just as Darwin and Newton, Einstein and Stephen Hawking saw the world with fresh eyes and wondered at the beauty of the green earth and the white moon among the stars, so may you behold the world with wonder and amazement. Whatever is sacred to you, may it be a blessing to you. May you be able to hold it lightly, like a bird in the hand, so that it will always return to you when you let it go. Have a great week.
Let us go in peace, ascribing worth to all that is worthy in life, with hearts warmed by our fellowship with each other, encouraged and supported in facing the challenges which confront us, and filled with energy, enthusiasm, and compassion which are to be found in our community of faith. Go in peace with hopes revived to live fully in a troubled world. And those words were from Eric Stevenson.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.